National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of a book of meditations and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs will build a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influenced his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss St. Francis of Assisi. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, exactly 700 years elapsed from the death of Theodoric to that of St. Francis of Assisi. And in that period, the world had been transformed. In St. Francis, we are studying the sweet, loving, and lovable awakener of the life of the Spirit, in whom is a reincarnation of the original impulse of Christianity. The time of St. Francis is a sealed book to many of us, since we carelessly class it with the Dark Ages, thus blinding ourselves to its light. There was a Dark Age in the history of Europe, following the ruin of classic civilization, but in that darkest time, a new force was building a new culture. A great hope had swept across the earth, coming out of the East, winning first the poor and oppressed, slowly working its way upward. When the Christian faith emerged at the top, it became the center of a new culture, strong where the ancient world was weak, if weak where it was strong. If the Middle Age despised this world overmuch, it recognized the sacredness of every human soul and was brooded over by the sense of eternity. The crown of that epoch was the wonderful 13th century, which began with the spiritual mission of St. Francis and closed with the frescoes and bell tower of Giotto and the Divine Comedy of Dante. That 100 years is so far away that we easily class it with the earlier Christian centuries. We forget that the world has always been modern to the men then living. They see the past as a long process ending in themselves. Thus, at the beginning of the 13th century, the world felt old. Christianity had developed its forms and ritual. There seemed no way to return to the simple gospel of the apostolic days. Out of common life rose the saints of the Middle Age. They entered the church and gave it a new lease of power, alike over the institutions and over the heart and imagination of men. You make your pilgrimage to Assisi, going down from Florence towards Rome, arriving in the late afternoon near the great church built around the little chapel of the Portiuncula, and take a cab to climb the hill to the town. Before you have gone halfway, the shimmer of the evening light on the gray-green leaves of the olive trees, the beauty of the Umbrian sunset so charms you that you alight and go the rest of the way on foot to enjoy the beauty of the hour. Suddenly there comes upon your vision the double church of San Francesco, one church built on top of the other, forming one of the most venerable memorials of Christian art. These churches were the natural theater for those painters of the dawn, Cimabue, Giotto, and their pupils, who were called down from Tuscany to paint in both churches frescoes instinct with the very spirit of Francis. The lanes climb steeply among the old stone houses of Assisi. Here and there little squares open out. At the top of the hill is the ruin of a feudal castle. Behind, rising bare and majestic, is Monte Subasio. Such is Assisi today, a stranded bit out of the heart of the Middle Age, preserved for our inspection. In the day of Francis, however, Assisi was a busy, active community, able to keep its little army for ever-recurring neighborhood warfare and to send its merchants far and wide to France and Flanders. Indeed, the father of Francis was one of the traveling cloth merchants of Assisi. It was on his return from one of those long journeys that he found the little son had been born, and the careful mother had already had him baptized under another name. The father had him rechristened Francesco, doubtless in honor of France. We know that in his boyhood, Francis came to know the newborn French minstrel poetry and song, for in the period of his mission, he would frequently pick up two bits of wood and pretend to play on one as a violin, but singing to the French music the story of the sacrifice of Christ. God's troubadour, he was called, uniting to the spiritual gospel the love of nature that marked the new French poetry and made it prophetic of what was to come later on. Intended a successor to his father in the cloth business, Francis paid little attention to that coming vocation. but spent his time in a careless round of pleasure-seeking with the young men and women of noble family. On one occasion, Francis went out with the men of Assisi to fight in one of the battles with nearby Perugia. Francis was taken prisoner and carried away for a year of captivity. During that time, he must have done much earnest thinking. Released, he returned to Assisi. The young companion sought him out, and he joined them for the old round of pleasure-seeking. But somehow it had lost its savor. More and more he tended to draw apart for meditation and prayer. A period of desperate illness followed, and during the weeks of slow recovery, again Francis did much earnest thinking. He rose from the sickbed a changed man. It was no longer possible to join his young friends. Instead, he wandered out the city gate, down among the gnarled trunks of the olive orchards, to a little half-hidden chapel, St. Damian, there to kneel in prayer before a medieval representation of Christ on the cross. We visited St. Damian. We too looked upon the Christ, kept today as a cherished relic in the older portion of the Church of Santa Clara. The Christ is somewhat awkwardly done by a forgotten artisan of the Middle Age, but with such sincerity that as we stood in the dim light and the dark-robed sister held the precious object up for our inspection, it almost seemed as if the Christ of St. Damian might speak to us. Must it not have spoken to Francis, ear and heart alike a quiver, waiting for some message out of the spiritual universe? So as he knelt there, the head on the cross seemed to lean toward him, the lips to move, and he heard at least sounding through every chamber of his heart the words, "Francis, build my house." Francis of Assisi was one of the few entirely literal Christians who do not make allegorical what is hard to fulfill as given. So springing to his feet, he saw the little chapel was falling in one corner and set to work to lift the rude stones back into place. Afterwards, this first annunciation was interpreted by his followers to mean that he was to restore the institutions of Christendom. To Francis, it meant doing the humble work just at hand with all his might for Christ's sake. Of this conversion of Francis, one thing may be said. Most men and women go through this world never facing ultimate questions except in rare crises of life, when the fabric of our ambition falls, when we have sinned, when death meets us and we stretch vain hands into the gloom, hungering for the touch of a vanished hand and the sound of a voice that is still. Then we cry out, "Why are we here? Whence come we and whither do we go?" The days come and pass, beating one after another on the sensitive shores of the heart, like the waves of a quiet summer sea upon the sand. The great questions get put aside and forgotten. There are some who cannot so forget them. Once awake, these few must wrestle with the angel, and even though lamed in the struggle, dare not let go till the blessing is won. Such an one was Francis. Meditating upon the words of Jesus to the rich youth, Francis saddled a horse of his father's, loaded it with rich cloths from the shop, drove to a neighboring town where a fair was on, sold the beast and its burden, and gave the money to the priest of St. Damian for the poor. Let us acknowledge he had less of common than of uncommon sense, the sense for divine things, all absorbed in seeking the one thing most needful, the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Freed by the bishop, Francis was able to go about what he considered his father's business. He dwelt for a time in an earthen cell near a poor little stone chapel, St. Mary's of the Little Portion. The spirit of Francis was not flight from a doomed world, but hunger to do Christ's work. He brought himself to serve the wretched lepers, then ventured to preach to his townsmen in the cathedral church. It would have been less difficult had he gone somewhere else, for no good comes out of Nazareth, and Nazareth is where we have always lived. Why, we say, we knew the boy's father. What can this son of a carpenter teach us? As they said in Galilee of old, so they said in the Assisi of Francis. There were two qualities in him that touched individuals in the throng. First was the man's absolute sincerity. He was speaking out of the heart of his own experience, not of something he had read about that happened long ago. With this, Francis had so loved the beautiful Umbrian nature world that it had become a language to express the spiritual gospel. These qualities touched men as they always do, as they did in the master Francis chose to follow. So they came to him, men of high estate and of low, eager to live the glad, free life of the Spirit. Francis had to pound their way of life. He taught them the three vows of medieval monasticism, but emphasized poverty. By it, he did not mean beggary. But everywhere he saw men enslaved to the things that should serve them, he urged them to come out and be free. But with it, he taught a more blessed gospel of work and personal service. Like his master, Francis knew all the beauty of personal service done for love's sake. Now there was to come to him the most powerful of all inspirations for noble living, the love of a woman. For no other word is quite good enough to describe the friendship of St. Francis and Santa Clara. Using it, I must add that in spite of all the scandal that has been heaped upon everything evil, no breath of suspicion has ever touched this sweetest of friendships. Indeed, this delicate wild flower of personal life is so fragile, one hesitates even to bend and breathe its fragrance, lest one crush its petals. Santa Clara, of noble family, had gone to hear Francis preach and been wakened to face in her turn ultimate problems. Appealing to Francis, he established her with other women at St. Damian. So the Second Order was born. The relation between the two groups in the early days was simple and lovely, with the interchange of courtesy and personal service that makes life sweet. That could not go on long, for Francis, like his time, never doubted the celibate ideal as the higher one. So just when he needed a friend who could understand, he had to fight his battle alone. A story tells it. At the time when the order seemed reeling to ruin, Francis went out from his cell on Monte Averno one winter night. The story says he knelt in the snow, wept bitterly, and prayed earnestly for a long time. Then he rose and made in the snow one large mound and a number of little ones, saying, "There is thy wife, and these are thy children." And the story concludes, returned to his cell, and was never tempted that way by the devil again. Early in his mission, Francis began those journeys which marked him as the wandering troubadour of the spirit. One of the first had been to Rome to gain papal sanction for the order. With this, Francis and the brothers were able to go far and wide preaching the gospel. Everywhere they found men and women eager to respond, as they always are when the same gospel is preached with the same sincerity. So the Third Order was born. The men and women came, and he had to plan the way of life for them. Now the inevitable happened. Men high in churchly authority saw that here was a wonderful instrument to be used for the purpose of the organization. Yielding humbly to them, Francis had the distress of seeing compromises made with the gospel of complete poverty, which he believed to be the teaching of Jesus. Toward the close of his life, Francis learned one more lesson, the hardest any of us must learn who would serve the world. The lesson that our work is to plant seed corn in the furrow of life, but the harvest is in hands higher than our own. With us, something of the old sunny nature returned to him. And with a lighter heart than he had known for years, he went to Assisi for a last visit with Santa Clara. There, in the little upstairs garden, Francis composed the most wonderful expression of his spirit, that canticle of the sun, which has been called the beginning of all modern poetry. In it, Francis thanks God not only for our brother the sun, but for winds and all weather, for our mother the earth, then changing the key for our sister, the death of the body, and that we may die in such faith as will bring us to the life everlasting. Not long after the end came to Francis, but his work goes ever on. Always true followers have been within the portals of his three orders, but not all are there. Dante and Giotto rank high among the true children of Francis, and there are those alive today who know nothing of his teaching, but who believe more earnestly in the things of the Spirit, because he walked the lanes and olive orchards of Italy, living and teaching the new old gospel of love, brotherhood, and personal service. Is he not a symbol of the living and teaching that will redeem the world in any time? It is not a new gospel that is needed, but the gospel anew. Thus, high among spiritual heroes, we place Francis of Assisi, the most perfect Christian since Christ.
St. Francis of Assisi has been the subject of this program in a new series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Copies of tonight's discussion of St. Francis of Assisi may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This is the National Broadcasting Company.